What I want to do in this lecture is go through the structure and order of the play. Look at the way it's arranged and put together. And talk about certain patterns and make certain observations along the way. And then we'll conclude. This is a quick overview, but I hope it will give you some structure, some sense of the play. And those of you that want to keep studying it, it's well deserving of studying. Those of you who may be teaching it, it deserves more time than I'm giving it. It's a wonderful exercise for those of you teaching to take one of the choral odes and have students do it. It really doesn't matter which version particularly, but get them up on their feet and make them say it together. And choral speaking is as good an exercise as choral singing. Well worth the doing. I'm going to start with something a little odd, but it's in order to get at one aspect of the play I haven't mentioned yet that's one of the most famous aspects of the play. I want to start with the position of the audience, and that is, it's 427 BC, it's the festival of Dionysus, we are the citizens of Athens, we go to the theater. We're not sure if this was the first, second, or third play, but it was one of them. They would have been spread out over the whole day. We go into the theater, we start watching this play. We have an odd position that is different from anything the characters on the stage have. Because this is a well-known myth, the audience already knows the story. That means the ignorance of the title character, Oedipus himself, is not our ignorance. The lack of knowledge of the chorus, and again, I made the point in the previous lecture that the chorus is in some way our link into the action of the play. There is a difference in this play. The chorus does not have the knowledge that we have. And insofar as I describe this as a murder mystery or the first great detective story, we know who done it from the beginning. Oedipus doesn't. The chorus doesn't. Jocasta doesn't. Creon doesn't. There is only one character in the play who has the same knowledge that the audience has. Total knowledge, and that is the prophet Tiresias. So that Sophocles has constructed this play in terms of its action in order to make the audience essentially at one with the prophet. Or we could say there is a sense in which the audience has something like divine knowledge as they watch this play. They know what the gods know. They know what the prophet knows. They know the overall structure of the story, what has actually happened, what remains to be discovered. And for that reason, even though Sophocles is viewing this question of the efficacy of prophecy and what the status is between the human and the divine, he's loading the deck in the way he structures the play. We cannot help but be on the side of the prophet. We cannot help but be in a position similar to that of something like divine knowledge because we know all of it. We have a sense of all of it. And he has written the play in that way for that reason. That's the way it is set up. This results in something very unusual. It's difficult to do. It will happen in other plays occasionally, and here it is overhanging the play from beginning to end. And that is what we call irony. It is a difficult word to describe, to define. But let me just say it is somehow a gap between what is being said and our understanding of it. The words are doing something different from what we take in understanding the words. And let me give you just an example of it from very early in the play. Throughout I'm very early in the play. Creon is just returning from the temple at Delphi. He's gone to the oracle. He sees him coming and says, Lord Apollo, let him, that is Creon, let him come with a lucky word of rescue, shining like his eyes. The first thing that Oedipus sees as Creon approaches, the shining in Creon's eyes. He's come from the oracle, and Oedipus speaks of eyes shining. What does the audience do? We groan. Why? Because Oedipus has said something that he himself doesn't understand. We know how the play is going to end. We know the story. Eyes aren't going to be bright and shining. They're going to be put out, and they're going to be Oedipus's eyes. And he uses the image shining like his eyes. We groan. Oh, man, he doesn't know what he said. This continues throughout the entire play. Oedipus, being told, we have to find the murderer of Laius, says, no, I'll start again. I'll bring it all to light myself. And we go, oh, that hurts. Why? Well, yes, you may do that. You may ferret out the truth, and you'll do it yourself. But the truth is, you're the problem. The truth is that you're the murderer. The truth is, you have defiled the city. The truth is, you'll hunt down the man. You the man, okay? It's just, oh, man. The audience knows all this. The audience knows all this. Oedipus doesn't. The gap between our knowledge and Oedipus's knowledge is huge, and we groan, and that gap is irony, okay? Not to mention, I'll bring it all to light myself. And there's Sophocles, the poet, playing with imagery again. No, you won't. You're going to end up in darkness, but the darkness will have the brightness of truth as opposed to bringing it to light, bringing it into the open, exposing it, at which point you have to go into darkness, blind yourself. Huge complications. And the poetry is playing like this all along. Our understanding of the action is playing like this all along. And it is irony. That is, the words are saying something to us other than what they seem to be saying. Irony is a very, very popular, difficult dramatic device. This play is ironic up until the moment that Oedipus gains full knowledge. And then we are at one with him. Then we understand as well. But until that point, there is a sense in which this play is the greatest groaner ever written. Every time characters open their mouths, we know more than the characters, and oh, if they only knew what they were saying, we're hearing the words differently. Very curious, I'll just mention this, I am not a gospel scholar, but in the gospel for last Sunday, a very curious moment that when I first came into the church bothered me a lot. And once a year, this gospel would roll around, and I'd be troubled by it. I'd be deeply troubled by it. Our Lord is speaking about the unjust steward. And I say to you, make friends for yourselves with the mammon of wickedness, so that when you fail, they may receive you into the everlasting dwellings. And I would go, what? What is that? That doesn't make sense. What's he saying? It took years before I realized, and I don't know if there's another example of Scripture, of our Lord being ironic, saying something, and we have to interpret it in a very different way from, go ahead, make friends with those children of mammon in the world. So that when you lose, you know, when you lose your soul, they'll have a dwelling place for you. Ooh. That, it's irony. It's a kind of irony. It's very rare. Very rare. The ironic tone of this play is not just one statement. It runs throughout about two-thirds of the action of the play, where there is a gap between, we have to reinterpret what's being said and understand it in a different light. Now, let's go to the very beginning. I've gone on and on about the action, the plotting. Aristotle insists on it. Let me try to give a sense of how it is working. I said, we begin at a particular moment. There is a pattern of action. Sophocles has taken a single moment in this story, and it's a moment that will run about an hour and 20 minutes, and it's the moment of discovery of truth, but we begin at the present time, a present moment. We are in Thebes just before the discovery. And Thebes is in a particularly unpleasant situation. The very beginning of the play, the first line spoken, the doors of the palace open, Oedipus comes out and says, "O my children, the new blood of ancient Thebes, why are you here? Huddling at my altar." Remember the altar I said that was always there in the orchestra? And indeed, you have a few figures, they're not yet the chorus. We'd call them in the theater now extras, a few extra bodies who, they don't get to talk, sing, or dance, they're just hanging around, they're filling up space. But they are to be, okay, other citizens of Thebes. They're huddling at the altar. Notice, Oedipus calls it my altar. And we get something very strange from the beginning. He says, "Yes, I know there's trouble here, you're burning incense. Our city rings with cries for the healer." The city needs help. The city needs salvation. "Wailing for the dead. I thought it wrong, my children, to hear the truth from others, messengers. Here I am myself. I'm sitting in the palace. Word could have come to me how bad it is out here, but I'm coming out directly. I'm going to see how bad it is. I'm coming out to you directly. Why? You all know me. The world knows my fame. I am Oedipus." We've got a little bit of pride there right from the beginning. He helps a priest up, old man, and says, "Speak up, old man. Your years, your dignity, you should speak for the others. Why here in kneeling? What preys upon you? I'm ready to help. I'll do anything. I would be blind to misery, not to pity my people kneeling at my feet." Ah! That's one of those moments. Play's filled with it. Okay? Yeah, you're going to be blind to misery soon enough. Oh, hurts. "Oh, Oedipus," says the priest, "king of the land, our greatest power." Notice what's happening here, and you should get it better than anyone else. Who's coming to whom for help and assistance? The priest of the city is coming to the ruler saying, "Help us." We are beginning with a very curious inversion. We would assume the ruler of the city would be going to the priest and saying, "Help us." The action of the play begins, and we have Oedipus, who is the figure that dominates, but we're going to see him in connection with a number of different figures. And the first encounter, the first dramatic exchange, is between Oedipus and a priest. Oedipus and a priest. And who's in charge? Oedipus is. And throughout the scene, we have the priest saying, "We're all here, men of all ages, clinging to your altars." The altars of the city, again, are identified with the ruler. Okay? Oedipus has taken over the altars. Why? Because once before he saved the city. So now they seem to be his altars. Not the altars of the priest, not the altars of the gods, Oedipus's altars. We're getting clues right from the beginning. Something is out of joint here, to quote Hamlet, okay? Something's maybe not rotten, but something's wrong in the city of Thebes. Something is amiss here, but we're taking it for granted because why? He's our savior. We'll go to him. Saved the city before. "Hear the old, bowed down with the years, the holy ones, a priest of Zeus myself," okay? "We gather now, kneeling before the temples of Queen Athena or the river shrine where the embers glow and die and Apollo sees the future in the ashes. Our city, look around you, see with your own eyes, cannot lift her head from the depths. The red waves of death, Thebes is dying." Okay? Curious. The priest says, "Now we pray to you." We have a priest in the city praying to Oedipus, not to the gods, not to Apollo. "You cannot equal the gods. Your children know that, bending at your altar. But we do rate you first of men, both in the common crises of our lives and face-to-face encounter with the gods. You freed us from the Sphinx. You came to Thebes. We taught you nothing. You triumphed. A god was with you, so they say, and we believe it. You lifted." We've got a confusion between man and God. We've got a confusion as to where worship belongs. We've got a confusion here on the part of the priest as to what his role is and what the role of the king is. We have, if you will, a man who is coming to replace the function of the priest and to be as if he is at one with the gods themselves. We've got an inversion here, right at the start, okay? Now, the very next thing that happens, Oedipus, and he seems to mean it, I'll help you, I'll do what I can. There's no doubting the sincerity of the man. It's part of his greatness. It's part of that nobility that's essential for a tragic hero. It's quite real. He says, don't worry, I've already seen the things. I've sent Creon to Apollo. His instinct is right. He's gone to the oracle. And we have a very brief scene where Creon comes in. Creon is going to reappear later in a different function. But please notice what we have here in the initial scene is clearly an examination of the connection between the gods and men. It's right at the beginning of the play. It's the first scene. And even when Creon comes in, he is simply in the role of a messenger from the shrine, from the temple. He comes in with a message from Apollo. The gods have spoken, okay? And we get the message, here's the problem. You have to find the murderer. Clean up the city. Oedipus says, fine, I'll do it. Now, before the next major scene, we get the entrance of the chorus. It's called the Peridos. It is the big choral song with which the chorus makes its entrance. The one here is fascinating, absolutely fascinating. I won't go through the whole thing, but I'm going to quote some of the extended passages because this is something that gets lost a bit in many of the translations I've looked at. Here, it hammered home. The chorus enters. They're citizens of, they don't know yet, they've heard the news that, of what must be done. They don't know. They are singing. This is Zeus. They haven't heard the news. They call Athena. Later in the play, beginning of the play, okay? Feed the fruits of our famous earth. Scream, you can watch them go stably. Some deaths, no rune on the ground, trailing in from all the wild hymn. You get the sense of just building. Remember Aristotle's definition of one of the aspects of tragedy, a song which was embellished speech. Embellished speech. You're getting that here. Drive him back, the fever, the god of death, that raging god of war. O Lord of the storm cloud, you who twirl the lightning, Zeus, Father, thunder death to nothing. Death is possessing the city. The city is Artemis, Huntress, torches flaring over the eastern ridges. Ride death down in pain. God of the headdress, gleaming gold, I cry to you. Your name and ours are one, Dionysus, the Lord of the festival that's now being celebrated. Come with your face aflame with wine, your raving women's cries, your army on the march. Come with the lightning. Come with torches blazing, eyes ablaze with glory. Burn that god of death that all gods hate. The obsessive theme of the first choral ode as they enter is death. Death. The city is being brought down to death. At the end of the choral song is the notion that the gods themselves hate death, but may be powerless in the face of it. It seems as if death is going to triumph over the gods themselves. I will pause here just briefly. This was one of the concerns of the Greeks that they could not get around. They had a measure of wisdom. They had a measure of piety. They had been given great gifts. What this play signals is that for all of their wisdom, their piety, their reason, their accomplishments, their attributes, their talents, they could not figure out death. Death looms there as the wall which Greek thought could not get over. And the question simply is, what is the greatness of man or his accomplishments if it all comes down to nothing? This is an idea that will reassert itself in Hamlet as the Christian world begins to shatter and come apart. Clearly, through Revelation, an answer to that question came with Christ conquering death. The Greeks did not have that revelation. We're talking 500 BC. Death is that enormous black question they can't get around. There are few greater visions of that horror of the city bound by death, a death that maybe the gods themselves cannot overcome. It's a question in the Choral Ode than this great entrance Choral Ode in Oedipus. It's stunning. It's powerful. It's frightening. It's haunting. It haunted Sophocles, obviously. Obviously. One of the great minds. And how do you make sense of it? What can you do with it? Oedipus comes back out from the palace, his first line to the chorus, "You pray to the gods, let me grant your prayers." Whoa! Whoa! Inadvertent pride, but he's saying, you want to know what Apollo said? I know what Apollo said, I'll tell you. But again, we get one of those strange, ironic moments when he is speaking for the gods. He is standing, if you will, in place of the gods. We again have something as disorder. But then he begins explaining, I will now speak out as a stranger to the story, a stranger to the crime. I really know nothing about what went on when your king was killed. If I'd been present then, there would have been no mystery. You were present. You're the one who did it. I mean, we've got a long way to go before the truth can come out. And he goes through a series of curses on the murderer. Irony, he's cursing himself. Every curse lands on his own head. The audience knows it. He doesn't. If you are watching this play, and we can now because we know the myth, brilliant staging at the Guthrie Theater. It wasn't done with the masks as Guthrie himself had done years ago. It was done in a kind of primitive setting, but the audience just writhes. I mean, there are times it's just, you want to stand up and just say, look, stop it, I'll tell you. Stop talking like that. Just curiously, exactly what Jocasta will do when she figures it out before her husband does. Stop. This is really getting painful. Don't go any further. That again is a basic audience reaction. Why? We don't want the truth. We know where it's going and we would prefer not to be made uncomfortable by it all. And again, the audience is in that very uncomfortable position. I won't go through all the curses Oedipus brings down on himself. It is a magnificent long speech, but he has an interchange with the chorus. The chorus says, he's going to save us again, thanks, with little knowledge of what's coming. And he says, I've sent for the prophet. We're going to take care of this. I've sent for the prophet. And the next big scene is with Tiresias. I won't go through this again. Well, I've spoken about it briefly, but please notice what we've got here. We have, in the first two scenes, two different ways of connecting with the gods. We have the priest, we have the prophet. The priest goes to Oedipus and says, you have to help us, you have to do something. The prophet comes in and says to Oedipus, I ain't talking. I'm not saying anything. We have the two figures on stage who connect with the divine saying, no. No, there's nothing I can do to help the city. No, I may be a prophet, but you're not getting my mouth open. I've got nothing to say. The functions of those in the world who connect with the divine have somehow been absorbed in the greatness, the gigantic stature, the pride of King Oedipus. Priest says, Oedipus, help us. Tiresias says, nope, if I said anything, you'd get really angry. So I'm not talking. And it is not until Oedipus threatens to torture Tiresias. Under threat of torture, Tiresias says, well, I'll talk, but you're not going to like it. You're not going to like it. And it simply comes very simple. You are the curse, the corruption of the land. You shame! He proves himself a good prophet in that he says, you're going to be really mad at me. No, I won't. You tell me the truth. Okay, here's the truth. You're the problem. Why you good for nothing? And we get the reaction that the prophet predicted. Which means, perhaps, what he says in addition should be taken seriously. Aren't you appalled to start up such a story? You think you can get away with this? Teresia says, I have already. It's a wonderful response. The truth with all its power lives inside me. Who primed you for this? Not your prophet's trade. You did. You forced me. Twisted it out of me. What? Say it again. I'll understand it better. Don't you understand just now? Or are you tempting me to talk? No, I can't say I grasped your meaning. Out with it again. I say you are the murderer you hunt. That obscenity twice, by God, you'll pay. We get the same reaction. Second telling of the truth. Same reaction. Shall I say more so you can really rage? The wonderful thing is, please notice, the voice of the prophet speaks with truth and accuracy, and suddenly he's in control of the scene. He is in absolute control at this moment. And he is being rejected by Oedipus, who is, for the second time, showing a side of himself that will bring him down. We spoke about the tragic flaw. In a way, this wouldn't have happened. Okay, we back up. Well, there was the prediction. The gods prophesied. Oedipus flees. But the moment when he begins acting out that prophecy is the moment when he kills his father. Inadvertently, doesn't know who he is. But excuse me, we're at a place where three roads meet. The chariots come together at the same time. The old man says, I'm going through first. Get out of my way, kid. The kid says, no, you're not. I'm going. We've got a traffic jam. Seriously, it comes to the matter of a traffic. We've got road rage. We've got Greek road rage. And you have these two characters shaking their fists at each other. Now, it ends in the same way. Tragically, it's happening on the highways now. Somebody dies. And you get, you know, on the evening news, you get these stories. Terrible event out on the interstate today because two cars came together and they got into a fight and one of them drove the other one off the road and killed him. That's what happens here. Oedipus kills Laius. Because of problems at a right away at an intersection, what have we got? We have a tragic flaw, which is wrath. Wrath. Anger out of size and proportion to the incident. Okay? Now, in case we didn't understand that from the story, what does Sophocles do now? He presents the same tragic flaw in relation to the prophet. We have a very serious moment here. This doesn't have to do with traffic problems. Oedipus calls the prophet. The prophet comes. Oedipus says, so tell me the truth. The prophet says, okay, here's the truth directly from the gods. And Oedipus goes bonkers with rage. Wrath. We are seeing the tragic flaw again. Because at this moment, there might not have been an easy way out, but perhaps it didn't have to be elongated and go as far. And finally, who is it that tells the great king the ultimate truth and finally gets him to believe? The ultimate truth, the final bit of news, comes from a shepherd. Comes from a humble shepherd. Not from the prophet. Prophet's not believed. We've got to go through the whole story, link by link by link, piece by piece, till we get to the little man who said, yeah, I took the baby from the house and I handed it to this guy who took it to Corinth. Boom. Got to have the evidence. Got to have the facts. I'm not going to believe what the gods say. I'm not going to believe what the prophet says. I reject all that. But, now I'm hooked. But it's at that point, Jocasta's already dead. Too late. Okay? And all of this has gone on publicly. Too late. We cannot in drama create alternative plays. But this is a moment when things should have stopped had Oedipus believed. Doesn't. Because of his rage. Because of his wrath. And we go on, okay? And indeed, the first thing that Oedipus says, Creon, is this conspiracy his or yours? This, and please notice, this isn't the god speaking. This is dirty politics. That's what this is. And the next scene is with Creon. This doesn't have to do with the divine. This has to do with politics. Okay? Abortion isn't about God's laws. Abortion is about Supreme Court rulings. It has nothing to do with God. This is politics. This is just American politics. And that is Oedipus's reaction. Okay? And Tiresias again, Creon is not your downfall. No, you are your own. Just, whew. And then the final thing before he exits, the blind prophet says, you'll tap your way. You'll tap your way out of Thebes. And what does the old prophet do? Blind taps his way out of Thebes. In one sense, Oedipus becomes very like Tiresias. He gains divine knowledge. The cost? His eyes. His power. The city. It's an extraordinary moment. Before Creon comes on, there is another choral ode. I'm not going through all these choral odes. Each one can be studied independently. They have a basic theme, okay? They're worth looking at. And this is basically, again, the connection between the decrees of Apollo, the prophet, and Oedipus the king. And the chorus is trying to make sense of it. They cannot make sense of it at this point. Scene with Creon. I'm running short of time. I'm going to have to race ahead. One thing I want you to notice, we get a bit of it in the scene with Tiresias. It's even more in the scene with Creon. It is a standard tradition in Greek tragedy. It's called stichomythia. And what it is a series of exchanges of single lines hurled back and forth, okay? Where you simply get one character and another character, and they're hurling single line after single line at each other. Standard device in the plays, just very quickly. Creon, what do you want? You want me banished? No, I want you dead. Just to show how ugly a grudge can. So, still stubborn? You don't think I'm serious? I think you're insane. Quite sane in my behalf. Not just as much in mine. You, my mortal enemy? What if you're wholly wrong? No matter, I must... Just boom, boom. It's a tennis match. Tennis match. Line by line, back and forth. And what we get is that increase of excitement in those individual exchanges. Please remember, the second actor just recently stepped out of the chorus. And we're moving toward, he saves it to a little later in the play where Jocasta, Creon, and Oedipus are there, and we've got suddenly a three-way. Ooh, that must have been really exciting for the audience. And of course, that comes next to these long choral odes. What have we got? We've got variety. We have extraordinary variety within the plays in terms of how they're being presented. I'm skipping over this court, over the ode. Creon comes, but please notice the pattern here. The sacred, okay? The priest. The whole notion of the gods. The prophet, different from the priest. The connection, the voice of the gods, if you will, speaking to the earth. And now where do we get? Politics. There is a movement here away from the divine on the part of Oedipus, who is seeking to avoid what the gods have to say, moving from the priest to the prophet to the politician. It's all politics. It's Creon's fault. It's simply a campaign maneuver because he wants to oust me and gain control of the government. Okay? I'm not going to go through it. It's a fascinating scene. It has to do with a couple of things. One, the attempt to rend that which is sacred, to turn it into something that is merely earthly and political. It's a standard ploy. And the oldest game in the book, which is called Blame Somebody Else. Okay? I see it with my 3.5-year-old nephew. Something will happen and the call will come from the parents, who did that? And he'll say, my sister. Okay? It was, Cammy did it, I didn't. Blame the 1.5-year-old. This is almost, I would say innateness, I'm going to talk about that innateness when we come to the end of the play. That's there, that's in us, where blame somebody else. Not my fault, somebody else's fault, okay? Not Oedipus's fault, Creon's fault. Creon's behind all this. It's a wonderful, and then we get, please notice, and then we get Jocasta, the gods. The gods speaking through man. The political, the domestic. Yes, she's queen, but she is wife. She turns out to be I mean, we're talking doubly domestic. It's mom too, but we don't know that yet. Okay? We are now inside the house. We are now in the realm of the domestic. This play is encompassing every human connection on earth. And we're moving from the highest on down as he rejects the priest, rejects Tiresias, rejects Creon, and now the scene with Jocasta, in which she joins him, I've already talked about this, in saying, reject the oracles, reject what Apollo says, reject the prophet, it's all just chance. And then in comes the messenger. I'm skipping over the choral odes now, I apologize. We should do a complete study of the choral odes. That's for another time. And in comes the messenger who simply brings a fact. That is, the king of Corinth is dead. We get a simple day-to-day fact from a simple messenger, news reporter, and Oedipus says, ah, my father died, I didn't kill him. Jocasta says, see, your father died, you didn't kill him. The gods are wrong, forget him. It's all just chance, it's all just luck. We have come to the point where the simplest detail of life in the world can no longer be understood. It is totally misinterpreted. Why? He knows nothing. The king of Corinth was not his father. There is no way that facts coming to him in the world can be understood, because he does not know the most basic, simple truths about himself, who his parents are. He doesn't know his own origin. And of course, this takes us back in the play to ultimate origins. He's rejecting the gods. He's rejecting the gods. He doesn't know his own parents. He doesn't know what to do to rule his own people. But he's sure feeling proud of himself because he beat the Sphinx. And as I said, Tiresias makes clear, you didn't even understand the riddle you answered. You're the answer to the riddle, not just man. You, Oedipus. He didn't even understand the truth of his greatest victory. Ignorance, ignorance, ignorance in this man filled with pride, pride, pride. And the more ignorant he becomes, and the more clear it is to the audience that he's becoming ignorant, the greater his pride becomes. Reject the gods. Reject the prophet. Reject any divine plan. It's all chance, chance, chance. I'm in control. I rule. I'm in charge. As we watch this grind on, and it's not that long, but I'll tell you, thank heavens, because as you're watching it, it grinds you down. What is clear? Man may think he's the measure of all things. But when he measures himself truthfully, he's going to be found wanting, ignorant, blind, foolish, proud, okay? We go back, I can't quote it exactly, but that magnificent verse from St. Paul, okay? And you know not that you are all those things. You don't know who you are. You don't know what your condition is. How dare you puff yourself up with pride? And then what happens, this is an extraordinary moment. I'll take the time to look at it. I'm running out of time. The conversation continues. The conversation continues with the messenger who has come in bringing the supposedly good news that the king of Corinth is dead. But as he continues to talk, it becomes clear that there are some problems here. And the messenger is saying, yes, he's dead. Yes, he's dead. Why are you so happy? And Oedipus says, well, boy, there was this prophecy. I was going to kill my father. And now he's dead of natural causes. The messenger says, oh, he wasn't your father. The first one to get nailed by it is, of course, Jocasta. Extraordinary moment. And the messenger says, well, no, he wasn't your father because another shepherd passed you on to me. Oh, no, I brought you to them. You were adopted. Who? Do you know? Describe him. The messenger, he called himself a servant of, if I remember right, Laius. At which point, imagine, there is not a line for Jocasta. But what happens? One body movement. A dropping of the giant mask. It's a theatrical moment. Sophocles doesn't put it into print. She can say nothing, but the life has just been knocked out of her. And at that moment, she knows. The next words are, that man, why ask, old shepherd? Oedipus is saying, get that shepherd, find out where I'm from. Empty nonsense, don't give it another thought. Don't even think, she says. What give up now with a clue like this? Fail to solve the mystery of my birth? Not for all the world, says Oedipus. And here again is his great theme, free will and determinism. If the gods ordained all this, then Oedipus was just fated. And there is truth in that. He is less free than a Shakespearean tragic hero who makes a clear and open choice. But Sophocles arranges this play so that Oedipus is still making choices. It is very clear there are moments when he could have said no or he could have stopped. He is a free agent, in a sense, who wills by his own action to discover the truth about himself. Even though if what he discovers is that something has already been fulfilled that was preordained. This play gives a fascinating depiction of the interplay between that which is determined and the human agent that has some ability to make choices. Oedipus could have chosen to remain in blind ignorance. And that tension between the two that probably cannot be resolved this side of the grave is fighting through this play. Both seem to be there. Both seem to be operating. Both seem to have their pull on human beings. But there is something else, and that is the notion that above all of that struggle, there is truth. The play asserts that there is truth. And that truth can be known, although you will pay a price. Because what will you learn? You will learn things about yourself. You can only move through it if you have that in you, eating at you, desiring to know the truth, and there will be the countervailing force that will try to keep you from it, not wanting to know. And what is the truth you will learn? That you are tainted from birth. What Oedipus finds out is that from birth he was tainted. There was no way around it. He faces it, and as a result of that, of learning that truth, realizes something must be sacrificed to the gods. And for the city of Thebes, and in order to perpetuate his suffering, he blinds himself rather than killing himself. Blood must be shed to make up for that great wrong that was done. In this play, the point I made at the beginning, that through reason somehow, through the seeking, Sophocles comes so close to certain profound truths. And though he lived in a culture that did not get that revelation directly, there is, to my mind, a special grace in this play. And great human truths that can be learned from it. And it is as timely now as it was when it was written. Because that tension between God and man remains there. That arrogance and pride of man remains there. That taint in man that pulls him away from the truth and fills him with pride remains there. In the little break, I was speaking with Mrs. Marin. This was in the last letter. I'm not giving anything away. Talking about the awful incident of the poor girls here in Winona. Incest. The father, with his own daughters. And Mrs. Marin's comment about the people who are living in the modern world, I quote her in her wisdom, quote, they don't want to know the truth, unquote. And then in reference to the mother who was out of the house working and didn't know what was going on, the mother saying, about the incest, quote, I was so blind, unquote. I hear those comments in the middle of two Oedipus lectures. I won't make the obvious parallels between our own current ruler and what's happened recently. I will say I don't think there's greatness there. I don't think there's greatness in the president. I don't think there's any desire to know the truth. But the sense of that wrong spreading out to an entire nation is obviously true. And I will end with this. A terrible burden for those of us who are believing Catholics. The refusal of those in charge of the church to listen to the clear commands of God. Assuming somehow that we know better, or we can act around it, or that God doesn't really mean what he says. I will just end with this. Remember Oedipus at the moment when that prophecy is fulfilled, which says, in the end, the Pope will consecrate my Immaculate Heart to Russia, though it will be late. Russia will be converted, and a period of peace will be granted to mankind. But if you know your Sophocles, you know great suffering must occur before that moment of humility and yielding to the will of God comes. Thank you.